Well, we're here to discuss the post-mortem, or heavy post-mortem, I should say. Carter Christian and I are along with Neil Blackman. This is the Yanks Are Coming podcast, and Neil, it's going to feel a little bit like a morgue today, but you were down in Port of Spain. Give us your thoughts.
It's just an astonishing collective failure. And there's not really any way to sugarcoat what happened. I mean, in my opinion, as somebody that's covered the national team for 8 years and been a fan my whole life before I covered the team, this is the worst day in the modern era of U.S. soccer, or was the worst day. And it's going to be a while before you pick up the pieces.
There is never been a feeling in my life from a sporting event like I've had the last 2 days. I mean, the only two things that were comparable, you could relate to one of them as a Gator, as a fellow Gator, was when, and it was more circumstances for me, when Florida lost the national championship game to Michigan State in basketball. I was in Tallahassee. I was working in Tallahassee. I was working in the Capitol among Florida State people, and I had also lost a bet, so I had to wear a green jacket the rest of that week and was humiliated. And then when Miami lost the Fiesta Bowl to Ohio State, not because they had lost the national championship, because of the way that went down with what remains to this day, I think people would agree, a very dubious call to keep Ohio State alive in that game, and they went on to win. So those were the two games in my history where I woke up the next day and just felt absolutely sick. The Germany game in 2002, I felt sick that whole day, but that was first thing in the morning. And by the end of the day, I'd gotten over it and thought, you know what, we had such a great World Cup run. We got to the quarterfinals. We were fortunate. We beat Mexico. We were fortunate we advanced because of that Poland loss. And I haven't felt that this way about a sporting event since. And I have to tell you, 48 hours later, this is the worst feeling I've had about a sporting event, to the point where it's like I'm not motivated to do anything else. I'm just wallowing. I don't want to say wallowing in self-pity. I'm wallowing, but also looking for answers for the future, which I'm sure we'll discuss as we get deeper into the show. But let me ask you, Neil, this has got to be, from the standpoint of just the eye test, one of the worst U.S. performances of the modern era. I mean, I can only think of a few. That Guatemala game last year in the sub-hex. There was a game in Costa Rica in the sub-hex in the 2002 cycle where actually we were unlucky because there was a terrible call at the end of the game, but we just didn't look right that whole game. There was a match, I would say, the match against Honduras in the 2002 cycle, that was with Bruce also, the one in RFK was
right.
Particularly lethargic. But I don't remember, other than games in San Jose, okay, we'll take the games against Costa Rica out of the equation. And I mentioned the game in Costa Rica from the sub-hex, let's throw that out then. I don't think I remember one where we were this just not interested.
Yeah, non-at Costa Rica games, the most this and you mentioned the Guatemala match. You know, maybe the Haiti match in the 2015 Gold Cup, where the U.S. were pretty much just pushed around by Haiti. They won.
Right.
But they were
dominated in the midfield in that game. I remember tweeting something about how James Marceline, who you and I both covered with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, had Mick Stiskerud in his back pocket the whole night.
Yeah, right?
It was that bad.
You know, but you know, the point being, not only was it obviously one of the worst performances, but it has to be the worst performance just because essentially Trinidad and Tobago played a B team. And also, oh, by the way, you may have heard this, this game was for the World Cup, you know? So.
Yeah, you know, that Honduras game in 2001, I remember thinking was the biggest disaster because what it meant was that we were going to have to scrape to get to third, and there was no playoff in those days. But really all it did was it forced us to get a result in the final game of the Hex against Jamaica, and we got a draw, and we went through. So it was... this was more, and we know what happened in 2002. This was more serious because this was it. I mean, this would have been if the Honduras game had been swapped with the Jamaica game that year, then that would be a co-equal. So this is the worst performance. You and I can agree. Worst performance in modern U.S. men's national team history.
The worst.
Yeah, sorry, the worst. Start giving us your thoughts from Port of Spain as this debacle is progressing.
Well, as it unfolded, and I think there were a handful of... Some people, I think, thought, oh, same 11. And I don't mean some people in the media. I mean among, you know, fans and even the really learned people that I follow on Twitter and in other platforms are kind of like, okay, same 11. Makes sense. You just obliterated Panama. And to me, I thought that was curious just because Brutus Arena is he's so committed to method. Yeah, and I don't mean that in a tactical sense, because we all know he's very pragmatic. But I mean it in the broader picture sense. He's conservative, and when he finds something that's working, he tends to not divert from it. So what had been working for his 7 years in charge? Squad rotations. And it's part of the reason that he was three wins, one defeat, and two, and three draws.
And it worked in 2002 in the World Cup. I'll never forget being stunned for that Mexico game, waking up, because remember, that World Cup, it was early in the morning, waking up, we didn't have Twitter in those days. You get the lineup by turning on the television and seeing Eddie Lewis and Josh Wolf in the starting 11, thinking, well, what is this? This is crazy. And guess what? They both had, I mean, Eddie Lewis was fantastic, was off the charts in that game, and Josh Wolf had a great game also. Bruce always had a way of pushing buttons when he would rotate, and maybe it's a reflection of this squad. He just didn't have faith in the guys who weren't starting, though. I think
he had it all cycle, though, which is that's what's so weird, right?
Yeah, that is so weird.
You depart from this system that is working. I mean, you're you've gotten a result in 6 or 7 matches in charge.
He's even been rotating the goalkeepers in
He had been rotating everyone. And, you know, you top that off with the fact that Trinidad had a lot of time to scout the diamond. I'll get into that in a minute. And then the secondary issue is that it was hot Friday night in Orlando. It was warm. It was hot. The second half of that match was a little bit more of a grind than the cheery atmosphere kind of let on. You know, I mean, Pulisic didn't do a whole lot of running or jogging until Monday night. You know, it was just really strange to me. Bobby Wood played 90 hard minutes. You know, I thought that they'd make four. I thought they'd make less changes, and I wrote that in the Yankees coming preview. But I thought they'd make changes. I thought we'd see DeMarcus Beasley. I thought we'd see Jeff Cameron. And to start the same 11 was a gamble that Arena doesn't usually make.
The decision not to start Beasley at left back was particularly curious for me, because I thought that's the reason you call him in. You need a result. You need a veteran. You need a stopper. You need a guy who positionally is going to understand the movements that Trinidad is going to bring you in wide areas when they're counterattacking. And he went with Villafania, and we saw the result, right? I mean, that's where Trinidad won the game, was on that wing.
Right, and then that's something that I think we discussed before we started recording, is like, look, the first 15 minutes of the game, you didn't have a sense that anything was going to be dreadfully bad. But your sense was the U.S. were flat a little bit, which is odd because they're playing for their World Cup lives. And the U.S. was getting worked on the left flank because Villafania was having a lot of trouble 1v1 because he's not a great 1v1 defender. And because Darlington Nagbe, you know, is not a real good defender. And instead of helping, I think Darlington got kind of caught in between two worlds of showing for Michael Bradley to give him some help out of the back and helping on Villafania. And so when that happened, Trinidad had all this space on that flank.
And Nagby's not positionally astute. And I've observed this even in Major League Soccer. And our friend Coach Chris Gluck has observed that too as a Timbers guy. The solution would have been to play Bedoya instead of Nagbe, or make that change at halftime. Although at halftime, you're already down 2-0, right? You could have been down 3-0. Howard doesn't recover. That was the one mistake Timmy made in the game, but he recovered on the free kick I'm talking about for Trinidad and Tobago. But the damage was already done at that point, and I guess maybe Bruce felt like going forward, if you're going to have a lot of the ball, Nagby's a guy one-on-one that can make more happen than Bedoya. I think if you asked Bruce, none of us are ever going to get the question into him in the near future about this. But if you asked him, I'm sure he would say that was a big mistake. He should have started Bedoya, and he probably should have started Beasley. And maybe the other nine remained the same.
Yeah, they might. You know, I thought that maybe he would start Dempsey just because Clint has such a knack for that kind of moment. And I mean, you saw when the U.S. had the chase that, you know, there were essentially two players that were making plays, and they were Pulisic and they were Dempsey. And, you know, Dempsey was very unlucky once, and then Fonsette makes an incredible save on him on a second effort. You know, and Wood, too, grinding. But
why isn't Fileharbor brought on earlier?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you know, because if we're going to get into this with Arena, for me, and I'm a Bruce Arena fan, and everybody knows that, that's listened to us or that's read me, this was a debacle. This was an Arena debacle. And I thought the subs you just brought up, I thought his subs were bad. I actually thought Dempsey was too late. I think that the U.S. needed, when they got behind 2-0, I would have made a tactical substitution. Just because, what in the world?
This is essentially a knockout game. Okay, forget other scores. Right. Forget what's going on in Panama City or what's going on in San Pedro Sula. Pretend like you have to get a result, right?
Yeah,
to get through.
You have to get a draw.
So you burn a sub in the first half. We've seen, we saw England do that against the United States under Fabio Capello. Girondolo was killing James Milner on that wing, if you remember, in the first half. 31st minute, he brings off Milner, brings on Sean Wright Phillips. After that, I mean, we got the Dempsey goal because of the goalkeeping error, but they were probably the better team after that. We were the better team the first 30 minutes in that game. Capello made
certainly
a sub.
Certainly were.
Yeah.
Had the better plan.
Right.
And
Bob Capello had a great plan for that game, right?
Right. Capello makes a terrific adjustment. Arena didn't – he didn't make the proper – he didn't make really any proper adjustments. And I thought, yeah, I mean, the Fileharbor substitution was late. And then I thought it looked like the U.S. down 2-1 was just sort of panicking.
Flinging long balls forward. It was – if you had kept the ball on the ground and worked – through Pulisic in the middle, I think there were probably spaces and gaps that were going to open up in the TNT defense. And we did that a few times, in fairness, but the composure wasn't there most of the time. That's the word I would use, composure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, where was it? And then, you know, and what I mean by flat is that, you know, yeah, you're off with your touches and you're a second late to 50-50s. How many second balls did we lose, Garnick? I mean,
I just had a Twitter exchange as we record this with Hercules Gomez, where I said we lost 90% of the 50-50 balls. I think he probably agrees with that. I'm guessing Herc agrees with that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, when you scout Trinidad and Tobago, A team or B team, you know, what are the two things you have to do? You know, you got to win second balls, and usually you don't want to concede fouls at dangerous spots. But the corollary to that is you need to close down space when somebody that has a pretty cultured right foot can use the cultured right foot. So when Alvin Jones has the ball, say, you know, where he can take a crack, you might want to close that space down. And guess what? When you're losing 1-0 in a do-or-die game, you might want to close that space down really fast.
Yeah, you don't tempt Jones to take that shot. The worst thing that's going to happen for Jones is it's going to be a goal kick, right? So you're inviting him to shoot, and there's no, I don't know where Nagby and Villafania were on the play, but the gaps were between the back line, the back four, and then the midfield 3, if you want to call it that, was massive at that point. And the game shouldn't have been so stretched in the 30th minute or 31st minute, whenever it was. We were down 1-0. It was still a very manageable situation, right?
Right.
You don't,
of course.
But when you give up the second goal, then you start to panic. And we talked about a lack of composure. But my guess is that they were in such disbelief after the first goal, they began to lose their composure and lose their shape and lose their organization.
You know, they may have not ever really had the composure, though. And this is a point that I think needs to be made, right? Which is that when you start the same 11 and you take the gamble to depart from the methodology that has gotten you to that point, right? There are one of two reasons you do it. One is you reward it and you're just, you know, let me go out there and I'm confident that this is the right group I have. But it also smells a little of arrogance. And the reason that I bring that up in the context of Arena is, you know, and this is after the game, the U.S. have lost at this point. You know, he says, well, I feel like this is a roster that needed a lot of work before the World Cup. There's some things that have to be addressed and some players that have to be brought in. And it was an alarm bell moment for me, Kardik, because why would you wait until you're qualified unless you're that arrogant about the process and you just think you're going to get through no matter what? And what is the distinction between qualifying and integrating the new faces and then bringing them on in between? And I just don't understand that, but it's because Arena, you know, I guess the rebuttal is probably Arena has always played the guys he trusts. But if you're going to acknowledge moments after failing to qualify for the World Cup for the first time in 28 years that you had a flawed roster.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't have a rebuttal. I tend to be a Bruce defender, but I don't have a rebuttal for that. I don't have a rebuttal for the 11 for this match. I said the two obvious ones to me were Villafania and Nagby. Nagby being even the more obvious one. Beasley, I would pick because of his experience in these sorts of atmospheres in CONCACAF. But if you're trying to build for the future, assuming you qualify, you need to get Villafania that game. But the decision to start Nagby, and I know I picked on Nagby this whole cycle, but I just think there are much better options in the pool or the potential pool, since Sasha doesn't even seem to be in the pool anymore. But we'll say Sasha Kleiston's the potential pool. And then with Dax and with Ali Bedoya, you've got players that you're already calling in that, to me, are better options in that role.
Yeah, I mean, Darlington's in his late 20s now, so...
Yeah, he'll be 28 next year,
here's the thing with Darlington. You know, it's funny because they brought him down to Trinidad in the Sub-Hex qualifier, and he was one of the players that Klinsmann had isolated as saying, hey, you know, I love his understanding of attacking soccer. I love his vision for fluid football. But the knock on him has always been, for all the vision he has for attacking football, he lacks that sort of discipline defensively. He's not invested. He doesn't want to suffer defending, as our friend Hercules Gomez says.
Right.
And he doesn't have – I just don't think he has the mentality in international football.
No, I don't think he's an international footballer.
I think the physicality of it bothers him. I think the pressure bothers him. And, you know, he is the classic player that has done himself a disservice by staying in Major League Soccer and being a star. And if anyone is upset with that take, that's fine, because we've had to listen for 2 years to all your fanboy takes about how Nagby's the truth and he's the second best option to Pulisic. Name me a game where he was a difference maker.
Or even from some of the MLS fanboys, if you want to use that term, claiming he was like co-number one with Pulisic. It's Pulisic and Nagby, the future. This is the new attacking-oriented U.S. Midfield. I mean, I don't know how you can even compare those. You can't even have those two guys in the same conversation. It's laughable.
Well, right. Like, and you know what? And the knock before on Nagby, before these two matches, was, you know, he's really good against teams that aren't very good. And when the level gets raised, he's anonymous. Well, he was anonymous largely against Panama after they put Armando Cooper on the field.
Yeah, after that change. And keep in mind, Panama made a change at that point. I was giving you the example of Capello, right? That's what Arena needed to do.
Great point. Panama made a tactical substitution. Now, you know, it didn't ultimately help them win the game, but...
It settled them down, though. I mean, it didn't change the scoreline, but the eye test for Panama, it probably gave them the confidence to go and do what they did Tuesday night.
And it neutralized what Nagby was doing, which was probably part and parcel why they did it. But, you know, so just concluding the point that I'm making, it's just, you know, yeah, Nagby now against the Trinidad and Tobago B team is bad on both goals.
Yeah.
He's out of position, woefully out of position. And then he offered very little getting forward and turned the ball over. You know, in for me, Kardik, in his late 20s, forget it. Bye. We'll try somebody else.
Yeah, no, I don't think he needs to get another cap, another look. We have to stop giving out participation badges in this program. That's one of the things we'll talk about later in the pod as we look at big picture. Let me ask you about Jozy Altidore, because I've been one of his great defenders. I was so pleased with how he played Friday night, the response to the critics, and then he has quite possibly his worst game in a U.S. shirt. Certainly his worst game with something on the line.
I thought it was one of his worst, wasn't it? And you know, yeah, Josie's a good soccer player. I'm tired of even having that debate. He was wonderful with the ball on the floor. He's been marvelous for the Americans in World Cup qualifiers.
He finds space. And he does.
You know what's sad about this is he's yet again denied the chance to showcase his abilities in an international tournament, whether by injury or now by not qualifying. And he was one of four players, the others being Omar Gonzalez, Michael Bradley, and Tim Howard, that took half an hour of questions after what had to be one of the most agonizing moments and nights of their professional lives. So, you know, Josie, you know, I think any American fan can be proud of what he's become after kind of bursting onto the scene at 17. Maybe for me, and this is the moment in the podcast where I try to keep my emotions in check, maybe for me, Altidore is the saddest story of Tuesday night. Just because he didn't have it. And his manager could have fixed that by, you know, using him for 30 minutes or something.
Yeah, you start Dempsey alongside Wood, and then you bring him on. If you pick up on that in training.
You play with one forward.
But you just play
Bobby Wood by himself.
Right. And then you don't get run over in the midfield, right? If you inserted, you could probably still play Nagby with Bedoya or with Dax. It would probably be Dax in that case. And you sit Dax a little deeper, and Michael can go forward a little more freely and doesn't have as much ground to cover in that diamond. You play in a 4-2-3-1 or something like that. Yeah, that might have worked, actually. That's a good point.
I mean, I still would have gone with Bedoya and not McCarty just because I feel like they get pushed so far back with him. But
yeah. That's always been the criticism of Dax, and that he moves the ball. He doesn't move the ball forward, right? He goes side to side, but he keeps the ball moving, which we needed.
You're right, and you know what? And side to side in a draw is fine.
Yeah,
that gets you to Russia,
right?
So you know, you might be right. Maybe that's the guy to do it. And the other thing about McCarty, which is also an argument for Bedoya, either one of those guys is going to give you fight. You know, I mean, I thought that one thing that bothered me in the Panama match, and I thought this was, Marina made two answers in Orlando that I'll tell you about that were red flags, and I didn't see them as that until I saw the first 20 minutes of the game. The first one was another departure from his normal method. He said Thursday, we haven't even looked at Trinidad and Tobago yet. He told the media that. You know, and okay. You're really focused on this Panama match that you have to win. I get it. But every other qualifying game, you said we have a two-game plan. So he departed from the two-game plan. The second thing he said was, you know, oh, the competition rules are so stupid that you can't have enforcers. To me, when Pulisic is getting hacked like he was against Panama, you know, a 22-year-old Michael Bradley would have blown somebody's legs up.
Jermaine Jones would have started a fight.
Yeah, Clint Dempsey would have Dempsey-faced somebody.
Right, yeah.
Somebody needed to knock the hell out of someone on Tuesday night when the U.S. got behind 2-0. Even if it wasn't after a foul to Pulisic, just pop somebody, and if you get a yellow card or you get sent off, and you're 10-11 against what's functionally an NASL side, then you're 10-11. But you still got better players. You know, they needed a jolt. They needed, you know, they needed to fight, and I just didn't see it. I thought they panicked, and it was just so strange to watch that. And I think it's one of the things that Taylor Twellman kind of mentioned, right? Like, you know, where was the urgency?
Right. Now, I think Taylor's take, we can get into this, is a bit different than some of the other analysts' take. Some of the analysts are saying, well, this just set of players isn't very good. I think that there's some truth to that. This is
ripped the players enough, though. Let's talk about it.
But Twellman thinks, and I agree with this, I mean, if I have to pick one side or the other, I'm on his side, that there is a systematic failure and a culture that we have allowed to seep into this national team program. And I've heard similar comments from the likes of Casey Keller in the past. I haven't heard Keller since the game on Tuesday night. I'm sure he's had a lot to say about it. I just haven't seen it. But guys like that who've said, look, there's something different. There's something soft about this. And he didn't think it was because of the players specifically. It was because of the culture and the comfort level that some of these national team players have in Major League Soccer and in national team camps. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, we both wrote articles saying that there's systemic problems in U.S. soccer. And, you know, I do think that there's a little bit of they are a little coddled now. It's amazing that they made all this progress. But, you know, and this, I'm not going to pile up on Michael, because I think Michael had the best text of any U.S. player. You know, other than maybe Pulisic,
yeah.
Right, other than maybe Pulisic, I think Michael was very good most games. He was less good Tuesday night, but so was everybody else. And I can tell you from where I was that he was one of, and you said you saw Tim Howard, I guess, also trying to get people going. But other than Howard and Pulisic and Bradley, I didn't see anybody.
I'd still say Bradley was our second best player on Tuesday night. Pulisic was our best player, clearly.
Sure,
he normally is.
Right, he just wasn't as good as he was against Panama.
Right.
It was monstrous, right? So, like, but the point being, you know, one of the things about Michael going into the tackles hard or something like that is you know, these players benefited from competition, and I think the only guy, Altidore is maybe the only guy arguably right, it's been better since he came home.
Yeah. I mean, I think Bradley is training at Roma with the likes of De Rossi and Totti and Nalumann and, yeah, Panic and Struman. Those training sessions must have been invaluable. I know we want our guys playing every game, but then if you're on a team club like that, look, if you're not getting games at Sunderland like Josie was, okay, that's Sunderland, come home. But if you're at Roma with that set of players, I think the training is probably as valuable as game time in MLS. And I've made this point for 3.5 years since he came back. Now it's almost 4 years since the January of 2014, that it was the specific situation he was in, the specific club with those specific players in midfield. And if you have to fight to keep up with them, that improves you as a footballer, even if you're only playing in cup matches.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I think there's something to that. And you know, these sorts of things matter when your high-end talent is either not selected for the squad, in the cases of Fabian Johnson and Timothy Chandler,
yeah,
and arguably Danny Williams, and Jeff Cameron, who seriously isn't on the field for 180 minutes. You talk about a guy that's a fighter.
Well, so when you made the comment about the fighter and I said Jermaine Jones and you said Dempsey, right away I thought Cameron. What's Cameron doing on the bench? Why isn't he in the game at that point?
There's an NBC Sports story, which, you know, the author was not in Trinidad, so I don't know where, you know, I have no idea where the information came exactly down from, other than that, I guess through sources, there was that, you know, that rats on a sinking ship, so things are leaking, that I guess Cameron was called in, and Arena told him, this doesn't sound like Arena, which is why I thought it was a fishy story, just said, oh, well, we're going to go with Omar over you. because we don't think you're fit, even though he had just played 90 minutes for Stoke. So, you know, I just thought it was bizarre, and it's almost like Arena blames him for the goals against Costa Rica and just decided you're going to be a scapegoat as well. But
has Cameron been punished for his public support of Jurgen Klinsmann? I just have to throw that out there.
Well, that's, yeah, right. Like, but Cameron's publicly supported Jurgen. And, you know, for all the criticism we've made of Jurgen, and so this is, before our listeners think, oh, now you guys are back, this failure is partly on Jurgen too, okay?
Oh, absolutely.
But Jurgen appears to have been right about Nagby.
Yeah, I think in hindsight we can all agree on that. You got that one right.
That seems to be a judgment he made that was correct. Jurgen seems to be right about Areola, although Paul had no business starting. He was exhausted Tuesday.
But Areola's a guy I think never gets called in. I'm going to give Jurgen credit for that one. But that's a guy who never even gets a look.
He was right about him.
Yeah.
You're right. Bobby Wood.
It's another one.
Is there a player this cycle that did more for themselves than Bobby Wood and Paul Areola? Those are both the Jurgen guys. So, you know, and guys that Jurgen said, I want that guy.
See, this is why Jurgen could have been the technical director. I think he understood the guys to select. I'm not going to question that. Areola, Wood, he called in Pulisic earlier. He got us a number of good players going in this pool by looking at them. Matt Beisler is another one. If you want to go back a cycle, that may never have been selected by another manager and then became indispensable.
Matt played pretty well on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Matt played well against Panama,
but
did admirably spelling John Brooks.
But Klinsmann's man management and Klinsmann's tactical game plans were just not at the level they needed to be for a team with our deficits in talent and in quality.
No, they weren't. And you know, in Arena, and this has always been the deal with Bruce, though, right, Karnik? I mean, you've covered him for a long time. Arena has nights where he gets the tactics spectacularly right, right?
Yep.
But when Arena bombs, like historically he bombs.
He like bombed in the really. Czech Republic game. That's a classic example. And he made a couple changes to the lineup for the Italy game and got
it
right. And I think
against Italy, right?
And I think generally against Ghana he got it right. And there was just the horrible call on Gooch, which, by the way, I mean, this is off topic, but that was the fault of Bocanegra playing a ball back into his area, not Gooch's fault. But the Czech Republic, we were chasing that entire World Cup with arguably our most talented team ever. You know, everyone talks about 2002. I would argue 2006. It was just as talented, although Johnny Yeo was obviously at the end of the run was injured. But you had
They were a great team talent-wise.
Right, but you had Dempsey by that point, and you had Beasley and Donovan as more finished products. So I would actually argue 2006 might be as strong a team. But we were chasing the World Cup the whole time because of the tactical mistakes in that first game. So yes, Bruce does have stinkers.
And we pay for it, don't worry. Right. He has these vapor lock games.
You know, in that game, he started Convey, Beasley, and Eddie Lewis. Three guys who essentially play the same, you know, who are essentially the same position, and tried to put one at left back. I can't even remember who he played where, but one at left mid, one at left back, and one at right mid. And only one of those guys should be on the field. So what Bruce had tried to do against the Czech Republic, and this is important to talk about for this game, what he tried to do in that game was get his best 11 on the pitch rather than go positionally, and then he fixed that for Italy. Is that what happened in these two games?
It sure seems so.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the U.S. looked tired. They looked unengaged. The first half was the worst I've seen an American team play. The worst.
Yeah.
And I mean that's saying something, because there've been some stinkers out there. You know, it was so bad, and so you know, and some of it's a shame because you know this failure is so on Arena for Tuesday, in my opinion. But then, you know, Bruce also got results in six of his eight matches in charge. circles back to Jurgen Klinsmann, circles all the way back to the man that I think orchestrated this failure the most. The lion's share of the blame. And lion's share is the wrong term, because if you had like a percentage index, you know, you wouldn't be over 50.
Right.
But Sunil Gulati, he needs to resign or be fired or run the World Cup committee. But his days of his 12-year term of running U.S. soccer needs to be over.
Yeah, I completely agree, but I've made myself perfectly clear on this subject, and I think it's even more than
just... We both wrote lengthy articles on this question, which you all are free to visit. I would certainly visit Karnik's at World Soccer Talk. But, look, there were red flags throughout this cycle, weren't there, Karnik?
Yeah, and I think the first... The start of this was actually in 2010, when I don't think he wanted to publicly back Bob Bradley after we had won a World Cup group. And
right.
He was looking for reasons to make a change. And there's so many things that are off the record, and I usually keep things close to the vest. I'm going to actually say something here that has been off the record with me for seven and a half years. I'm going to let it out. Sunil was talking to journalists trying to find reasons to critique Bob's performance after we lost to Ghana, and obviously the Ricardo Clark mishap of starting him, but you know, Bob Fixer, that was another first half substitution. My goodness, the theme of this podcast. Bob made that change, and we were the better team after that, right? He brought Benny on, if I remember correctly. He brought Feilhaber on, which could have been done by...
Yeah, Demir just misjudged the ball.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what...
Yeah.
Right.
So
and you know, okay. You live with that though.
Right. So my point is that Sunil Gulati was looking for reasons to get rid of Bob Bradley, who is, I think, with hindsight, although a lot of us thought this at the time too, absolutely the best manager we've had in the modern era. You may be Bora, but Bora had a different circumstance. It's Bob. So I think that's where it began. He was infatuated with Klinsmann. He was infatuated with Klinsmann, but not infatuated with Klinsmann enough to let Klinsmann actually have control of the ship, right, and make the sort of player decisions that maybe needed to be made in terms of younger players. And then there have been all kinds of mishaps that I've written about with the women's national team and the management of the lower divisions with NASL and USL and the FIFA scandal and Chuck Blazer, all of that. We don't need to talk about all that today. But his presidency has taken the U.S. from a place where we were – okay, after his first term, he had Bob, and none of these problems with the lower divisions and women's game had popped up yet. But we were in a position where I like to compare us to South Korea, Japan, Australia, three other major industrialized nations that where soccer, football isn't the first sport, but is developing a following and is trying to join the first world, if you want to call it that, in terms of the sport. In my estimation, entering Sunil Gulati's second term, we were probably slightly behind Japan, and we were ahead of South Korea, and we were ahead of Australia, well ahead of Australia. Now, we're looking at a World Cup where obviously Japan and South Korea qualified easily. Australia is still alive. That's who we would have faced if we'd been in the playoffs, and we're out. And I think we've fallen behind South Korea and Australia at this point on his watch.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we've fallen behind Australia, but I think we're certainly behind South Korea.
Yeah. Yeah, Australia is the one that's kind of co-equal with us, and they have – Australia has – I had this conversation with a journalist yesterday. They have almost identical issues to us and identical leadership problems. And that's why if we had gotten up to the playoff and played them, it would have been very interesting because it would have been like looking at ourselves.
And then they got in the playoff because they had fight.
Well, they got into the playoff because they have one player who –
They had fight.
Right. Well, yeah.
They had the guy on the field that was like, you know what? We're not going.
They have a guy who in 2010 I called. People just still give me a hard time about this and think I was saying he was the best player in the world. I never would claim that. I would never claim Timmy Cahill is the best player in the world. What I said was he has more influence on positive results for both his club and country, at Everton at the time and Australia. No player to me at that time had more influence on the success of his particular club in his particular country. And
not even Landon Donovan,
not even Lionel Messi. I mean, he was that important to both club and country. And he
not even Thierry Henry.
Henry might have had that like 8 years earlier, but so he has the fight. He had to will them through. Syria was winning that tie if not for him. Where was that guy for us?
Right. And that's what was so, you know, cuz Michael Friday night was I mean, it was incredible to see, you know, the way he was motivating people. And I think he wanted to try Tuesday night. You saw him at times, you know, getting after people and getting in people's face. But he also was overwhelmed by Marina's tactical decisions, which I keep coming back to. And I think, look, Arena was the safe hire and the prudent hire for Gulati to make, given the circumstances that Jurgen Klinsmann left him in. But the reason that Jurgen Klinsmann left him in those circumstances is less about Jurgen Klinsmann and more about Sunil Gulati.
Yeah, oh, you're right.
If you heed history...
I'm not blaming Klinsmann for that.
Yeah, and if you heed history, and people are going to throw maybe Vicente at me or something, and that's fine. There's always exceptions. But if you heed things historically, second cycles fail. They just fail. And there were times in the second cycle before the nitty-gritty of qualifying began that Gulati could have corrected the path and changed course. And instead, while getting sued by the women's national team that was the world champion, while dealing with a domestic abuse that they tolerated prior to the World Cup,
right,
while all these other things are going on, wow, as you mentioned it, not being able to cede enough control to Klinsmann, and then not being able to pressure Klinsmann to do the right thing and bring Landon Donovan to Brazil.
Yeah.
Instead exercising his personal vendetta and putting, you know, Josie out the door and no other healthy forward on the team. You know, he gets this opportunity to change course on October 10th, ironically, October 10th.
Oh, wow.
2 years before the day of infamy, October 10th, 2017, the U.S. failed to qualify for the Olympics for the second consecutive cycle. The U.S. loses the CONCACAF Cup 3-2 in a game that was far less close than that score. To Mexico, failed to qualify for the Confederations Cup. He doesn't change management.
And a game where Jurgen Klinsmann tactically put Kyle Beckerman and Jermaine Jones in absolutely awful positions, where two very accomplished players, veteran players, could only fail tactically where he put them in that Mexico game. We don't need to relitigate that.
No.
I mean, Jermaine ran his socks off at 34, 35 for 120 minutes.
In
100-degree weather. It was obscene. If he had had a heart attack that day, I wouldn't have been surprised, as cruel as that sounds. I mean, he ran his socks off.
He said the same thing after that game that he said Tuesday night. I thought Grant Wall's head was going to explode. I mean, Sunil says,
yeah.
Well, you don't judge a whole program by 2 inches wide or 2 inches deep. You know, I guess referring to Dempsey hitting the post in the second half. And it's like, Sunil, this is what you said after, you know, the Confederations Cup and Olympic failures. In 2015, you basically made the same exact quote almost, and we're just like, you know, Paul Aguilar doesn't hit that volley more than once out of 100 times. Well, he did.
Right. And on the balance of play, you were second best that day. Same thing in this game.
You weren't even close to as good.
You
got a wonder goal from
Bobby. Same thing in this game. Let's be honest about it. If the U.S. had stolen a draw, they had no business stealing a draw. They were completely outplayed in this match. And it seemed like anything, I don't know, you were at the stadium, I wasn't, but it seemed like anything after Pulisic's goal, for the next 20 minutes, maybe until the Fehlhaber sub, or maybe it was before that, it seemed like if there was going to be another goal in the match, it was going to come from TNT.
It did seem that way for a little while.
And I thought at some point TNT would pack it in. We would be pressuring them. They would make a defensive error. There would be a bad clearance. We never put them under the sword, to the sword that way.
No. So let's just start here. Because there are two ways to kind of direct that conversation. One is, you know, there's systemic problems with U.S. soccer. What now in terms of those? But I think that's probably a separate podcast. We can get in. So are there solutions to the pay-to-pay problem? Obviously, I don't think it's something you can ever eliminate. We should probably talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to have plenty of time to do additional podcasts. I thought you and I both thought we were going to do podcasts looking at squad and World Cup, but we've got a lot of time, so we can table that discussion next time.
You know, what do you think, my friend, about is this next hire the most important hire in the history of U.S. soccer?
It's probably the second most. I think, and again, Sunil stumbled into it, but I think after the 2006 World Cup failure, where everyone, myself included, had absolutely, and this is why I've talked this week since this game so much about self-delusion, and a lot of people in our fan base and in the media, some of our colleagues in the media, have self-deluded themselves into our quality level because of what happened in 2006. In 2006, I had this impression that we could go to the World Cup and maybe not win it, but get to the semifinals, and that we had these incredibly seasoned and tested players. And as I said earlier in the show, I still think that might have been our most talented team, but they weren't a World Cup semifinal level team. I was completely unrealistic. After that failure, we stumbled around. We fired Bruce, which I actually at the time thought was a mistake. Sunil stumbled around, couldn't find a replacement, talked about Bielsa and Peckerman and Klinsmann and all these guys, and stumbled into Bob Bradley. We didn't play a game. We didn't even have a friendly for 8 months or 7 months. And we were rapidly coming towards the start of qualifying a Gold Cup and then a qualifying cycle and an Olympic qualifying cycle for the U23s, and he was forced to pull a trigger and hire Bob Bradley, give him the interim tag. That was probably as important. Actually, you're right. This is a more important hire because that was coming off a World Cup failure. This is a failure to qualify for the World Cup. There's a difference.
That was kind of why I thought, because to me, Karnik, what's happening, and you know, maybe one day I'll look back at it and say it was a horrible time, but an exciting time. I'm not there yet, and you know, I had a lot of fun actually on Twitter laughing at the people who were like, this is the best thing ever happened to U.S. soccer. No, this is a colossal disaster, and what we do now is a great opportunity. But to say already it's the best thing to ever happen is to read into a future that I haven't seen yet.
Right.
So spare me that nonsensical narrative. All this is right now is a colossal disaster that loses us $250 million, probably.
Yeah.
That deprives John Brooks and Christian Pulisic. I include Brooks because he's a young star. A stage to showcase pretty prodigious talents.
And probably Josie Altidore, Michael Bradley, and Fabian Johnson, yeah. A last real showcase in their prime.
Exactly. A last, especially for Michael, who's been such a great servant. You know, but certainly Brooks, who hasn't, you know, I don't want to say ever, he was very good at the Copa America, hasn't always shown in a national shirt what he's capable of. The World Cup was going to be a marvelous opportunity to kind of showcase a pretty prodigious talent, a player that anyone in the Bundesliga is high on almost.
Yeah. Well, and Ralf Hannenstein has compared him to Jerome Boateng.
Yeah, I mean he's got that kind of, you know, technical ability. He really does. So this is a disaster. And whether it's the best thing that ever happened to U.S. soccer down the road, that's to be determined. But don't make that conclusion now. Be careful how you articulate and frame failing to qualify for the World Cup. That's my soapbox on that, my friend. But I think this hire is one that they need to deliberate about. And, you know, maybe in the interim, maybe they can convince Bruce.
No, that was what I was about to say. I think they might be best advised to let Bruce
in tournament
until, you know, so we schedule some friendlies for November, maybe schedule some friendly for March, and then at that point you've got a new coach in place and maybe a new president in place.
Right. I mean, he can't cap, you know, now he can't cap tie a guy like Jonathan Gonzalez for a while. Until 2019, right?
Yeah, until the Gold Cup in 2019, right?
Yeah, I mean, you got some guys that are dual nationals. You can't cap tie for a couple of years, but
Carter Vickers,
you know,
is another.
John Levy, my colleague, sent out a tweet last night saying he felt like the U.S. should take really young teams to Europe this spring and play the send-off series games for other countries with extraordinarily young groups. And maybe you take Michael with him, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of, you know, Michael might retire from international soccer. Who knows? Maybe he won't.
You take an Olympic team philosophy. You take a U-23 team plus three, you
there
know,
you go.
Right? Maybe plus three and a goalkeeper. Oh, actually, yeah. No, not plus three and a goalkeeper anymore. We need to.
Right. I don't want to see anybody but Horvath and Hamid.
Right. Yeah, it's got to be one of those two.
I don't want to see
David Bingham might sign in Europe somewhere. Maybe you give him another look
I've actually heard today that there is some interest from Bingham in that Hearts.
Oh, that would be good.
Among the teams that are interested, I think
speaking
Hearts
of which,
Wolves.
Perry Kitchen's a guy you recall.
Right. There you go, Perry Kitchen. I heard Wolves, who have a great relationship with U.S. goalkeepers.
Yes.
And also inquired about David Bingham. So, that's cool. You know, maybe you bring him, Horvath and Hamid, or you bring Stefan, the youngster in Columbus. But you got to change at the goalkeeper position. So it's kind of time to say goodbye to some people, too, right? I mean, that's it for Tim Howard. That's it for Clint Dempsey's career kind of ends anonymously with a post. You know, I can't see Michael playing in a World Cup in Qatar, but I think he could play a role in qualifying, kind of like Jermaine Jones did.
Yeah, like Frankie Hadok did in the 2010 cycle.
Right. A lot of these guys are done, though. I mean, you know.
I wonder about Jermaine Jones. As poor as he's been for the Galaxy this year, honestly, he always had something more for the U.S. than he did for club teams.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
Needed to bring Jermaine back for these games. I mean, I know we're just spitballing after the fact,
yeah,
but we needed a guy that was going to light a fuse. Maybe he's the only guy that could have done it.
That could be Altidor in the next cycle, too, right? I mean, Josie will be 32 in 2022, so certainly not too old to be an influential player in a World Cup. The thing about Josie is that there's so much mileage on those tires.
Yeah, he started playing full-time at 17. And he got his first call-up to the senior national team in the sub-hex against TNT in 2008. So he's been with the full national team for 10 years now.
Right.
And been the starting striker basically that whole time. We had Ching and Connor Casey and Charlie Davies until 2000. But basically from the summer of 2009 onward, he's been the number nine for this national
team. Well, yeah, exactly. And until Christian Pulisic started against Trinidad and Tobago and Jacksonville, Josie was the youngest player to start a national team game. So, you know, senior national team game. So, but I think maybe you break that record, right? Maybe you bring this Durkin kid.
So it might have been actually even earlier. Now that I remember, I was at the game in Houston against Mexico in 2008, in February of 2008, and Josie scored in that game. So that's
right. I mean, yeah. What if you might consider? My point is, you know, I think John's right. I think you bring as many young people as you can on some sort of European tour in the spring. They're going to have trouble selling tickets for home games. So, they might as well go play good people.
Yeah, they've already had trouble selling those tickets, as we know, because of ticket prices. There was, I think, a lot of dissatisfaction with Klinsmann. That kind of rebounded with Bruce. There was a honeymoon period with ticket sales. This is not going to help. That's why I have said publicly there was part of me that thought maybe we need to miss a World Cup so we have these conversations we're about to have. But still, on balance, 90% of me said, no, we can't, because there's all these other ramifications. And psychologically, you still never recover from not being in a World Cup. I mean,
correct. You're not wrong to suggest that we need to have those conversations, and not making a World Cup forces them, right? Like, that's not an incorrect suggestion. In fact, I think it's quite right. There is a difference between saying that and saying, oh, missing a World Cup is the best thing that ever happened.
Right.
Right? We don't know if it is, because we don't know. We just don't know what U.S. soccer is going to do.
My sense is that they may not do the right thing unless there's a lot of external pressure. And the only way there can be external pressure is if people continue to be engaged and are involved in supporting and following the national team program. And that can't happen if we don't have meaningful games, or games that seem meaningful, even if they're friendlies. So it's kind of a catch-22, because without meaningful games, which is what is going to happen now, next competitive match is in the Gold Cup in 2019.
Well, it'll be kind of weird to see. Like, maybe they'll put together some sort of weird tournament like they do for the women.
We had just had the USA Cup, and the last year we had that was Bruce's first year. I remember '99 we played a US Cup match, if I remember, and we lost it. It was Bruce's first loss as manager, but we haven't played that tournament since. Maybe 2000.
Well, that's what's funny is people make these suggestions, and you're like, yeah, that's a cool cash grab idea, and you'll make some money, and you'll play some good teams, and maybe because it's the United States, some of those guys in good European clubs would come, right? Like, if you invite Chile, maybe they bring an A team, or at least a B plus team. But to me,
maybe if you bring the Dutch in,
right? Yeah, but that sounds cool. I think it's a bad idea, right? Because isn't the idea that you just didn't qualify for a World Cup, and so you have 17 to 19 to 20 to 21, 22 year olds that need games. They need senior-level games. Take them to Europe. Get clobbered by England.
Right.
Right? I mean, you know, play at Wembley a week and a half before the World Cup and get smoked. These results don't matter. You know, it's 600 days till we play another World Cup qualifier. Wrap your head around that. This is just so upsetting.
Yeah, I think this is where we have to have the conversation also about the management and the style of play, because I think what we're finding is pragmatism only gets us so far, right?
Yeah.
We have to have an identifiable style of play, and we have to start implementing that at the youth level. Now, Klinsmann said all this stuff, right? I'm saying the same stuff he said, but he had no idea how to implement it. And I think, given Jurgen's track record about comments, I think he just said it to placate us.
Well, he's a great, you know, we've talked about it.
Yeah.
I think you and I both think he's a boardroom guy. He's a great guy to have in, like, a meeting as a sounding board.
Yeah.
Because he'll say stuff, and you'll think about it, and you're right, he has no idea how to implement it, but he thinks it's a great idea. It's almost like the pay-to-play people that are like, you got to abolish pay-to-play. It's like, okay, well, how do we do that? Let's start that conversation, and they just give you a blank stare. Like,
well, of course, Taylor Twellman's suggestion was you throw the surplus that U.S. soccer has at giving kids scholarships. But now that we haven't qualified for a World Cup, we're going to need that surplus to survive. That's the problem.
Sure. And even if you don't need it to survive, you certainly need it for other things.
Right.
And I think that still doesn't solve the whole problem. But you're never going to eliminate it. It's here to stay. So you've got to find ways to neutralize its impact and influence. And this is a podcast. Carter and I will do a pay-to-pay podcast, and we'll get some people that know a lot about it. Not that Cardiff doesn't, but also know a lot about it, and we'll talk about it.
Oh, there are people who know more about the pay-to-play system than I do. And
that's what I'm saying. Let's get them on.
And solidarity payments and all of this stuff. The DeAndre Yedlin cast case is still that's still pending, obviously.
We can talk about this from a football perspective as capably as most podcasts you're going to find in this country. And from a football perspective, this is a disaster. And, you know, maybe the U.S. style is heart and fight and grit and hard to break down and counterattack. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? If you develop players that make that system go, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. But I think there are options to play a different way. I'm going to come back to Sasha Clyston,
sure.
Right? I keep harping on him the last few days. I've harped on him for a long time. He's the type of player that didn't have an international career of note because of the way the U.S. plays. And even Bob, who loved him and broke him in at Chivas USA, couldn't use him in the national team because eventually you're going to this counterattacking style. You've got Charlie Davies, and then after his injury, you bring in Herc Gomez. You bring in Robbie Finley. And you're playing that way. So there are technically gifted players that we don't know how to use that we do have that could play a more possession-based style. Benny Failhaber was one of those guys, right, for years.
Tim Ream is
definitely one of those guys. And Matt Miazga is one of those guys. Another guy maybe Bruce should have called in for this.
You would think.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I think Matthew Doyle, that was in Matthew Doyle's critique, excellent critique, of the squad selection on the MLS site, I saw he had made that point as well, that Miazga's a guy he would have called in for these two games.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was in torrid form. Yeah, I mean, Bruce just doesn't – he just won't play what he doesn't trust.
Yeah.
And he's never played what he doesn't trust, and it bit him. Here, because what had happened was he lost his trust in Fabian Johnson's form for good reason, but to not have him in camp at all might have cost the U.S. trip to the World Cup, because I just thought that's who they needed in like the 30th minute on Tuesday night. You know, get Nagbe out of that game.
No, you're right. I was making the I had said Bedoya or McCarty because of who was on the squad.
Sure.
The obvious thing is, you know, you have Fabian Johnson. You're putting him right in at that point. You're making that change in the 20th minute or 25th minute, 30th minute when same time Armando Cooper came in for Panama. Same time Sean Wright Phillips came in for England. All these games we've discussed. Same time Benny came in for the U.S. against Ghana, and you're changing the trajectory of the game.
So let's close with just kind of, you know, what would be 2018 was always going to be an important year for U.S. soccer. You know, what to you? Give me two things you want to see now.
I want to see a progressive appointment as the manager. The only guy I would trust to go back to among the kind of family is Bob, but he's taking the LAFC job. I am almost positive if Sunil is still the president, Bob Bradley would not entertain coaching the U.S. men's national team, even though his son's the captain.
I'm almost positive as well.
Right. So if Sunil is there, that's not there. So you have to go out and get another coach. And I'm not sure, as I think about the I know a couple of weeks ago I said, oh, here's my list. It's Caleb Porter and Jesse Marsh. But that was with the assumption we were going to qualify.
Right.
And then this was going to happen in August of 2018. And then now I think we're going to have to go out and get a foreign coach if Bob doesn't want to do this again. And again, if Sunil's around, I don't think he's going to want to do it again. I don't know who that guy is. We could start thinking about that guy.
And we haven't had a foreign coach since Bora, really, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't consider Klinsmann a foreign coach.
No,
he doesn't count.
American.
He's very Americanized.
He married into
Speaking of Jurgen, his son might have to be our hope. I'm hoping he gets loaned out or something at Hertha. Because
he's a kid in that goalkeeper group And I actually suggested it on Twitter yesterday, and some people were like, oh, he's not even close already. And I said, there's a huge difference between playing him in a friendly and having him in a camp.
We have 2 years to now on friendly, so we can play Jonathan Klinsmann and everybody in that same camp, that same space. We don't have competitive matches for a while.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to put John Klinsmann on the field for, like, France's send-off game in Paris. But it'd be cool if he was, you know, in the camp and training in at the chateau, at the Steve Sampson Chateau, right?
Out in the country, yes. And I will use this podcast to say this about Steve Sampson, since you brought it up. I think he's been vindicated 20 years later. I watched Tottenham Hotspur under Mauricio Pochettino. They are playing the Sampson formation with Dele Alli playing the Claudio Reyna role, with Tab Ramos playing the Christian Eriksen playing the Tab Ramos role, Harry Kane playing the Brian McBride role, and their wingers doing the same things that we had Joe Max Moore and Ernie Stewart doing. Sampson was just ahead of his time.
So I'll do my two things. One is, I think that if it's not Eric Winalda, who we need to get on the show, but if it's not Eric, I support Julie Foudy or any of the various capable women we have for U.S. Soccer Federation president. The women have 3 stars. The women's program needs some tinkering. But
yes.
I think, you know, we've increased investment. There are various things that are looking up there. You know, we're creating the younger players are far more technical than the older players. That's good.
Yeah.
You know, I think that would be interesting, but I think we need a new U.S. Soccer Federation president. And then, you know, yeah, play the kids. The Charles Blum.
If you get Charles, Eric, yeah, what Charles is talking about doing.
Play your kids.
If you, and I think Will also, Will's now writing about soccer again, or at least commenting on it on Twitter, which is great.
He sure is.
I know, and I'm glad he's back. I wish he would stay with us.
We need him.
We need him badly. This is a time we need Will Parchman more than ever.
We need you too, Kardik. You are certainly one of our more seasoned and important voices, and I think one of the things that I value most about this show is just that people get to hear a perspective that comes from a critical lens. You want the U.S. to succeed, but you're never afraid to kind of be harsh, and we need it.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate that. And on that note, we're going to end this podcast, but we're going to be back having these conversations really soon. We thought we were going to be previewing a intercontinental playoff or talking World Cup roster, but we don't have that. But we have a lot to talk about. Maybe we have more to talk about in some ways. So we will be back real soon in the next few weeks with another show about this. And in the meantime, we'll have some shows on the pro soccer scene, women's and men's, in the country. So
in the NWSL final in Orlando this weekend, everybody enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. Get out to that. And then we've got MLS playoffs coming up pretty quickly and NASL and USL playoffs. So if you're in Florida like Neil and I are, we've got a couple of NASL games here in the state that have been moved here. Puerto Rico FC is going to split their remaining home games between Fort Lauderdale and Orlando. So that's an exciting development. Well, not exciting because of why Hurricane Maria. But we'll be back with you soon. Everybody try and stay strong. I can't believe I'm saying this at the end of a podcast about soccer, but it's been an emotionally draining and upsetting time, and I know everybody who's listening to this is thinking the same, feeling the same way we are. We'll get through this together.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you for listening, and we will be back with you soon.